Growing AIDS caseloads in undeveloped countries could seriously undermine food production, sabotage industry, and greatly reduce the already small ranks of educated professionals, economists warned yesterday. Experts in business, farming, and international development also warned that the Third World, particularly the AIDS-infected regions of Africa, will face substantial social disruptions as the malady increases. The dire prognostications came on the second day of the Global Impact of AIDS Conference, the first international gathering to examine the political and economic implications of the epidemic of acquired immune deficiency syndrome. We face the grim and sobering prospect that in some developing countries, death by AIDS will shortly exceed deaths by all other causes combined, said Timothy Rothermel, an official of the UN Development Program. In all likelihood, this group will include many of those who have the most to contribute to the development of countries, he said. The results will be devastating, with a decline in the gross national product and the deferral and possible elimination of development programs just to meet the rising costs of AIDS. And again, that last paragraph again. In all likelihood, this group will include many of those who have the most to contribute to the development of countries, he said. The results will be devastating, with a decline in the gross national product and the deferral and possible elimination of development programs just to meet the rising costs of AIDS. Much of the concern about the dire social costs of AIDS centers on the AIDS belt, unquote, of Equatorial Africa, where the disease has spread rapidly through heterosexual transmission. An estimated 10% of sexually active adults in the urban areas of these heavily populated countries are infected with the human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, which causes AIDS. The World Health Organization estimates that the numbers of AIDS cases will be counted in the millions there by the 1990s. Rothermel noted that the Africans most likely to be HIV infected are the well-educated urban elites who comprise the core of the civil service and business class. In some cities, between 15% and 20% of this group are said to be infected with HIV, he said. As the numbers of sick mount, undeveloped nations with little money will have to choose between tending the ill and other badly needed development programs, experts said. Repeating a previous paragraph, Rothermel noted that the Africans most likely to be HIV infected are the well-educated urban elites who comprise the core of the civil service and business class. One of the things I wonder, and again, this will seem perhaps far out or paranoid or alarmist, quote unquote, to certain sections of the audience, is whether we're again looking at an echo of the Third Reich. Recall that one of the major themes of these broadcasts has been the incorporation of thousands of Nazi war criminals into the U.S. national security establishment, both through the incorporation of the Reinhard-Gehlen Organization, the Nazi Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, into the CIA, and via the Project Paperclip scientists, the Nazi scientists brought in to work within the U.S. defense industries, and also within the armed services themselves directly. One of the Nazi programs for those they considered to be racially inferior was to simply deny them higher education. For example, the Slavs in the Eastern territories were basically to be taught to count to 500 and weren't to, it wasn't viewed as being necessary to teach them to read and write at all. They were to become sort of a permanent slave class, only there to perform menial labor. What I wonder with AIDS, and what I wonder specifically if, and I say if, the forecasts in the coming out of that conference are accurate, is whether the spreading of AIDS in Africa is being done along the lines of instituting sort of a Nazi-like, a Third Reich-like policy in that part of the world, the ultimate aim being eventually to facilitate the development of the resources in those regions, in particular the mineral resources, without the active interference by elements of the general population there who might, under different circumstances, be clamoring for a greater share of the wealth to be derived from those resources. If you can turn them into a sort of permanent undermensch, then you don't have to share the wealth and you can derive greater profits. Again, that will seem alarmist, quote-unquote, to some people, but in light of past actions of our national security establishment, in light of the very, very compelling body of information that AIDS is, in fact, a biological warfare weapon, in light of the King Alfred Plan and other manifestations of what appear to be the King Alfred Plan, it's something I think we should keep in mind. Also, think about the choices eventually that many of those nations will have to make if, in fact, the data from that article are accurate. Many African nations do not cooperate with the World Health Organization, so exact figures about how widely spread AIDS is in Africa have yet to be established. Many African nations deny what Western experts say about their AIDS problem, One wonders whether perhaps if our hypothesis about AIDS as a biowarfare weapon is true, whether some of those Western nations are in a position to see to it that their predictions come true. Bearing in mind, too, the King Alfred Plan, bearing in mind the disturbing characteristic of AIDS in Africa that appears to be exterminating, quote, the civil service and business classes, unquote. One of the things we've been taking a look at in this country is our theory that, in fact, people whose situations disagree with the Nazi racial outlook that appears to be coming to the fore in this country are being done in similar fashion. We've taken a look at means that our national security establishment has of eliminating people in such ways as to make it appear to be natural death of one kind or another. We've taken a look at their ability to produce apparent heart attacks and cancers as well. The following obituary comes from the Washington Post of January 28, 1987. It's the obituary of Travers J. Bell Jr., and it reads, Travers J. Bell Jr., 46, founder of the only black-owned member firm of the New York Stock Exchange, died January 25th at his home in New York City after an apparent heart attack. He started the Wall Street securities firm of Daniels & Bell in 1971 with $175,000. The company has grown to a net worth of $15 million, specializing in underwriting securities of minority-owned businesses. Well, he won't be doing that anymore, and again, people do die at the age of 46 of heart attacks, of apparent heart attacks, but it's interesting as we look at the death at a young age of the only black-owned member firm of the New York Stock Exchange, and one which had been underwriting securities of minority-owned businesses. One wonders if perhaps elements in this country, similar to some elements we're about to look at, are intent upon eliminating the business and the black business and civil service class people in this country. And again, if that seems outrageous or alarmist, unquote, to people, bear in mind some of the information we've looked at in the past, other actions that our government has taken, such as Jonestown, etc., the Tuskegee Plan. It's not at all unlikely in view of history, and the situation, at least in our view, is that this is what, in fact, is going on. Very important story and a very ominous one appeared in the San Jose Mercury News of today, that being Sunday, March 20th of 1988. This is an AP story out of Charleston, West Virginia. Its headline, Racists Get Hiring Issue on Agenda. A white supremacist group has forced AT&T into asking shareholders to vote on ending the telephone company's minority hiring program on the grounds that blacks are intellectually inferior. The Racist National Alliance offered the resolution on the ballot for AT&T's annual shareholders meeting April 20th in Denver, and the Securities and Exchange Commission ruled that it must appear with minor changes in wording despite the company's objections. Skipping down on the story, the National Alliance, based in Washington, D.C., promotes the study of Adolf Hitler's writings. Its leader, William Pierce, also heads the white supremacist Cosmotheist Church, with headquarters in Pocahontas County, West Virginia. The National Alliance bought 100 shares of AT&T in 1986, and Pierce told the Charleston Daily Mail that the group's members had been working on the AT&T campaign for a year and a half. In a statement sent to shareholders, the National Alliance claimed that, quote, only 1.1% of blacks possess an IQ of 114 or above, a, quote, desirable, unquote, figure for most AT&T employees. We believe that to ignore data such as this in employment practices sacrifices the essential long-term benefits of personnel quality for the short-term approval of pressure groups, unquote, the statement said. The resolution says minority hiring has had, quote, negative effects, unquote, on morale among white AT&T employees who could, quote, feel discouraged and ignored when they notice that the company is actively seeking to advance non-whites. It should be noted that AT&T has officially encouraged shareholders to vote against this resolution. However, it should be noted also that the author of that resolution, William Luther Pierce, head of the National Alliance, is also the author of the Turner Diaries, a blueprint for waging racial war in the United States. In the Turner Diaries, the so-called Day of the Rope takes place, in which not only blacks and other so-called racially inferior people, but also race mixers and liberals of all types, are literally strung up all along the streets of the United States. And William Luther Pierce is no dummy. He has a Ph.D. in, I believe it's aerospace engineering or physics, one of the two. We took a look at William Luther Pierce in our series on the Aryan Nation, specifically in programs 12 and 13. William Luther Pierce Basically, his political geniture goes back to George Lincoln Rockwell, Führer of the American Nazi Party, whose Arlington, Virginia address and phone number were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest. And again, I think, at least at the present time, it wouldn't surprise me if that particular resolution was defeated. I certainly hope so. However, again, bearing in mind what could be coming in the future, I think this type of a trend where an explicit Nazi group, a group that advocates black genocide, should be able to perhaps influence AT&T hiring practices, one of the most powerful corporations in this country or the world. It's something to think about, and I think in the event of an economic collapse, again, a severe depression, and there's a very strong possibility that we're heading into one, the debt crisis, the deficits, and so forth being what they are, at some point in the future, I could see perhaps how shareholders of AT&T might be somewhat less reluctant to turn down a resolution of that type. And again, bearing in mind the passages from They Thought They Were Free, where each step is almost imperceptible and not very much worse than the other, and all of a sudden these little steps all add up to one big step. Returning again to those same reflections by that same college professor, let's review some more of his remarks, this in light of William Luther Pierce and the National Alliance's initial successes in getting that resolution on the AT&T shareholders referendum. Quoting again from They Thought They Were Free by Michael Mayer. And one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy. And some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, juice wine, collapses it all at once. And you see that everything has changed, and changed completely right under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now, you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God. The system itself could not have intended this in the beginning, but in order to sustain itself, it was compelled to go all the way. You have gone almost all the way yourself now. Life is a continuing process, a flow, not a succession of acts and events at all. It has flowed to a new level, carrying you with it, without any effort on your part. On this new level, you live, you have been living more comfortably every day with new morals and new principles. You have accepted things that you would not have accepted 5 years ago or a year ago, things that your father, even in Germany, could not have imagined. Think about this last sentence with regard to America. Suppose we say, you have accepted things that you would not have accepted 5 years ago, a year ago, things that your father, even in America, could not have imagined. Continuing, suddenly it all comes down, all at once. You see what you are, what you have done, or more accurately, what you haven't done. For that was all that was required of most of us, that we do nothing. You remember those early meetings of your department in the university when if one had stood, others would have stood perhaps, but no one stood. A small matter, a matter of hiring this man or that, and you hired this one rather than that. You remember everything now, and your heart breaks. Too late. You are compromised beyond repair. We're going to take one more musical break and then the concluding three items from tonight's prepared portion. Then we'll take phone calls up to 10 o'clock. We're now going to give you the final three items in the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. What we've been basically looking at is the fact, or our sort of metaphorical contention, or my contention, that basically what's going on in Central America is also going on in the United States, although just at somewhat different forms. We've been taking a look at the inability of people in this country to gain effective control over their own political situation, and we've been taking a look at what I feel to be death squads working this country. Now we're going to take a look at the direct relation between totalitarianism in the United States and the kind of foreign policy which we're currently witnessing on being utilized by this country and that part of the world. I'd like to begin the final portion of tonight's prepared portion of the broadcast by reading a quote which we've read from a number of different times over the years on this program. This is from a book called The Enemy, What Every American Should Know About Imperialism by Felix Green. It's published in softcover by Vintage Books, a division of Random House, copyright 1970. And in this book, there's a quote from Major General Smedley D. Butler, who was Commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps and the only American for quite some time to win the Congressional Medal of Honor twice. And Butler has described his career in the Marine Corps. He describes it as follows. There isn't a trick in the racketeering bag that the military gang is blind to. It may seem odd for me, a military man, to adopt such a comparison. Truthfulness compels me to do so. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I suspect that I was just a part of a racket at the time. Now I am sure of it. Like all members of the military profession, I never had an original thought until I left the service. My mental faculties remain in suspended animation while I obey the orders of the higher-ups. This is typical with everyone in the military service. Thus, I helped make Mexico, and especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central America republics for the benefit of Wall Street. The record of racketeering is long. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1902 through 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests in 1916. In China, in 1927, I helped see to it that the Standard Oil went its way unmolested. During those years, I had, as the boys in the back room would say, a swell racket. I was rewarded with honors, medals, and promotion. Looking back on it, I feel I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three city districts. I operated on three continents. And again, Smedley Butler, in addition to having issued those very eloquent words and won the Congressional Medal of Honor twice, also foiled the 1934 fascist coup attempt in the United States that we talked about on Radio Free America number 10, and which was the focus of the McCormick-Dickstein Congressional Committee, at which Smedley Butler gave that particular testimony. Obviously, the use of mob muscle, quote-unquote, extending that metaphor of Smedley Butler's, continues in that part of the world, and bearing in mind the quote from Kenneth Lamott's anti-California report from our first para-fascist state, where he talked about the California buffoon politicians who wouldn't hesitate to use their tremendous power. Bear in mind also the sort of underlying theme of the broadcast this evening, which is that basically there's nothing going on in Central America that isn't going on also in the United States, and that the reason why Americans have not been able to change effectively our policy in that part of the world, in spite of the fact that 70% of Americans, for example, oppose aid to the Contra rebels, or the Contra mercenaries, really, is a better way of putting it. The fact of the matter is our policies there continue uninterrupted and arrogant in their continuity, and the fact of the matter is, again, we go back to what wasn't done. We go back to the society projected by Kenneth Lamott, the society predicted by Mae Brussels, the society which stems basically from the events of 11-22-63, and until or unless and Americans take stock of just what that represented, our leaders, and Mr. Reagan in particular, now the president that Kenneth Lamott and Mae Brussels predicted he might become, and with the situation in America now having become, as Kenneth Lamott observed California to be in 1970, we see this kind of arrogance in foreign policy manifested again and again. And even though Congress once again cut off aid to the Contras, the fact of the matter is that Reagan continues apace. One of the things which the news media have not taken stock of is the fact that the same day that the alleged Nicaraguan incursion occurred, and the same day that Reagan dispatched 3,200 American troops to neighboring Honduras in response, or in a show of muscle, so to speak, just happened to be the very same day that the grand jury handed down indictments for the Iran-Contra scandal to a number of key Reagan staffers, including Oliver North. One wonders whether perhaps the move in Nicaragua was an attempt to overshadow and bury this particular situation we've seen in the past with regard to the Iran-Contra scandal, how a number of key things happened and appeared to overshadow elements of the Iran-Contra scandal, such as Gary Hart's dalliance with Donna Rice, the interesting connection of Donna Rice to Adnan Khashoggi, one of the central figures in the scandal, and the resulting covering up to a large extent of the first week of the public congressional hearings because of the popular sensation about Gary Hart's amorous doings. And again, one wonders whether the Reagan ploy of sending troops to Nicaragua was in fact an attempt to cover up the situation in Washington. In other words, the indictments were covered up by this show of force, and as Americans rally around the flag and flex their political muscles in response to the Nicaraguan threat, one wonders how much public attention will be focused on the indictments in the Iran-Contra scandal, as relatively mild as those appeared to be. Interesting story appeared in the San Jose Mercury News from Friday, March 18th of 1988. Some lawmakers have, however, grasped the possibility that Reagan's sending of troops to Central America is in fact a ploy for Contra aid, that perhaps by holding the sword of Damocles of American combat involvement in that region, he hopes to sway people to support aid for the Contra guerrillas. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News from this past Friday, March 18th, Dateline Washington headline, "Some lawmakers suspect Contra aid ruse." President Reagan's pro-Contra partisans rallied Thursday to support his decision to send American troops to Central America, but many on Capitol Hill saw the move as a ruse to overcome congressional opposition to resuming military aid for the Nicaraguan guerrillas. Administration officials acknowledged that a new Contra aid proposal was in the works, but they insisted that Reagan's decision late Wednesday to send 3,200 soldiers to Honduras for an emergency deployment readiness exercise, unquote, was a measured response, unquote, to a plea for help from Honduran President José Azcona. Secretary of State George Shultz, testifying before the Senate Budget Committee, said the troops are not in Honduras, quote, in a shooting capacity, unquote. Skipping down, Senate Majority Leader Robert C. Byrd, Democrat of West Virginia, called the move an overreaction, unquote, and said he has heard the administration cry wolf, wolf before in efforts to stampede Congress into providing more lethal aid for the Contras. Again, the point being here that the military is in charge of the country, and if the military wants a war in Central America, Reagan and the other presidents who are basically serving as yes-men for their situation, because they control the government and have since 11-22-63, the situation is going to go on unchanged. And indeed, the underlying theme of tonight's broadcast has been that the warfare in Central America has its very, very close analogy or analog in the United States. It's just that instead of kidnapping people, shooting them through the head, torturing them, removing their genitals, shoving them down their mouths, and leaving them in public view for intimidation, people in this country die of the apparent heart attack, the apparent stroke, the one-car automobile accident, the apparent suicide. They're found dead in their homes with the drawers rifled, where they apparently surprised a burglar and were shot. They're found lying on the streets with their watch and wallet missing, where they apparently were the victim of a robbery attempt. There are cancers, curiously timed cancers, and people who are shot by lone nuts. And again, as long as people continue to ignore the political realities of this country as determined on November 22nd, 1963, the same situation is going to continue to happen in this country. We're going to continue to see officially state-sanctioned murder, be it euthanasia, a response to the AIDS situation, AIDS itself, and the continued workings of what I have referred to over the years as the American death squads. Before we go to the phone-in session of tonight's broadcast, and unfortunately it's going to be a little shorter than we had planned, we were on about 12 to 15 minutes late due to technical repairs that had to be made on the phone system, and so that's why we were on late this evening. Be worth bearing in mind what I've been talking about this evening, worth talking about California, worth thinking about California, our first para-fascist state, and the continued working of the American death squads as we contemplate Central America and the seeming inability of progressive forces in this country to affect policy in that part of the world with any degree of decisiveness. Interesting obituary in the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, March 13th of 1988, that was last Sunday. This is the obituary of Reverend Jamie Mock Robbins. That's M-O-C-K-R-O-B-B-I-N-S. In the deaths elsewhere, we find Reverend Jamie Mock Robbins, 32, an early leader in the sanctuary movement to aid Central American refugees Thursday in Seattle of cancer. In 1982, his church became the first in the Pacific Northwest to declare itself a sanctuary for refugees fleeing persecution in Central America. About 50 refugees have been sheltered at the church. The Reverend Mock Robbins spent much of the past 4 years working in Central America with schools and churches. He organized relief in 1986 for victims of the San Salvador earthquake. And again, since as we've looked at it many times in the past on this program, The U.S. National Security Establishment and the intelligence services have, since at least 1954, had a means of giving people cancer. Presumably with the advances in medical technology since then, their means of giving people cancer are probably more effective, and we've taken a look at the deaths of many, many people, political activists, people active in Central America or one or another aspect of the peace movement, progressives of all kinds who have died of cancers, and one wonders whether the death of Reverend Jamie Mock Robbins at the relatively early age of 32 of cancer, and is in any way related to his early leadership in the sanctuary movement to aid Central American refugees, as we've looked at in our study of the Rex 84 martial law plan revealed in the Christic Institute suit, or indeed rather in their affidavit. One wonders, well, we've seen the opposition of the National Security Establishment to the sanctuary program. One wonders whether Reverend Jamie Mock Robbins' death is a product of that opposition. Food for thought and grounds for further research.